Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
The Telegraph. The Telegraph. Podcasts.
Hi there, podcast fans. I'm Tom Gibbs. Welcome to Telegraph Audio Football Club. Today, Frank Lampard, in association with the Chelsea Football Club, lose 4-0 at Old Trafford to an impressive, if somewhat fortuitous, Manchester United. Where did it all go wrong for the Londoners, or are United now brilliant again? It's business as usual for Liverpool and Manchester City, who prove yet again that they're very, very good at football. Elsewhere, Spurs, Brighton and Burnley all impress on an exciting opening weekend. Plus, a look at transfer deadline day, the first games in the Ligue 1 season, and players our panel would risk an injury to meet. Let's take you now into the audio recording facility, where I'm joined by a good man, JJ Ball. How are you, JJ?
I'm good, Tom. That's good. A nice intro. Thank you for that.
A pleasure. Always a pleasure.
Now I'll be extra good.
we'll play with the adjectives as the season goes on. Alongside him, it's a reasonable woman, Mina Rizuki. How are you, Mina?
Hey, why's that?
Just having a bit of fun.
That's
Mina.
That's so mean. If you did a good woman, it would have been nice.
Okay. We'll keep it in mind for next time.
No, it's too late now. I won't be good. I'll be the double on this now.
Completing our lineup, it's a debut for the season for the boy wonder, Sam Dean. How are you, Sam?
I'm good. A slight cold, but I won't let it get in the way too much.
That's
new
good.
Season, new me, all
isn't
that.
Is he still a boy wonder?
Yeah, we're getting close to the point where we might have to look it up. What's your age now, Sam?
26.
That's still young.
I feel old.
Yeah.
I feel old.
You feel old. Shut up. Sorry. That was kind of a lot more bitter than I imagined it would be.
Well said, Mina. You've spoken for the audience there. Let's start with Manchester United. A 4-0 victory for them. A drubbing of Chelsea. Ole Gunnar Solskjaer back at the wheel. Frank Lampard struggling to steer his Chelsea team anywhere positive in his first league game. Before we get into it, let's hear from our Northern football correspondent, James Ducker, who was at the game. Here's what he made of it.
Ole Gunnar Solskjaer has talked all summer about the need for Manchester United to hit the ground running. Well, they've certainly gone and done that here at Old Trafford today with a 4-0 win over Chelsea. They were highly encouraging debuts in defence for Aaron Wan-Bissaka and Harry Maguire. And another debutant, Daniel James, came off the bench to score United's fourth goal. A difficult afternoon in the end for Chelsea, but they had chances of their own. Tammy Abraham and Emerson hit the woodwork, and they did ask questions of United before it became a very difficult and more one-sided second half. Very interesting at the end too. Paul Pogba was the last to leave the pitch, but made a point of applauding all corners of Old Trafford, and that applause was reciprocated. And as he approached the tunnel at the end, he went, took off his shirt and went to hand it to a young United fan. A very different scene from the final day of last season against Cardiff, when he was involved in a altercation with a supporter, perhaps an attempt to build bridges after a summer when he's been angling for a move to Real Madrid, maybe. But it was pretty much a perfect start for Solskjaer.
So, depending on what you make of that, Pogba possibly staying, possibly trying to mend some relationships, or possibly off saying his goodbyes. We'll see about that. But let's focus first on the new arrivals at Manchester United. Debuts for Harry Maguire and Aaron Wan-Bissaka. How did that change Man United's defence, Mina?
Well, it improved them quite drastically, to be quite honest. I thought Harry Maguire was obviously quite a shining star for them, considering that he's new. He won all his duels, like in the air. He was strong. He read the game really well, I thought, actually. He knows when to step in, when to make the difference. Aaron Wan-Bissaka is one of the few right backs in the world who really understands when to move forward, when to come back, how to defend, how to attack. He is really a perfect purchase for them. Having said all of these things, and as much as I thought that their purchases were really good and their defence was so much more improved from last season, I do have a problem with the structure and the midfield. So, and I thought that Jose Mourinho, who, by the way, I thought made a great pundit, pointed that out quite effectively. And he just said, the problem with Luke Shaw is obviously, like, you're going to have to cover for him. And I was like, yep. And he said, and if Harry Maguire is having to help with that, then that's going to leave gaps at the back, which the midfielders need to be the ones who plug these gaps rather than having to shift any of your centre backs. And this is something that I think they really need to look at. And this is where it's really important to have a defensive structure. We underestimate how good Liverpool's midfield are protecting the centre backs and protecting the back line. And as good as Virgil van Dijk is, you're only ever as good as your teammates around you and how much they're willing to sacrifice as well and plug any gaps that you might have missed. And I think that's going to be really important, whether or not people will try to shift Maguire out of position, because you can do that with him. He does like to come out and play the ball from the back. So it'll be interesting to see how that will develop and whether the midfield will understand and whether Solskjaer will find ways of plugging gaps, whether it's Luke Shaw moving forward and then someone just dropping in, and to see what happens.
I suppose what you've got with Van Dijk as well is he doesn't do a lot of that, does he? He stays back generally.
He does. He's
not
very
someone
disciplined.
Who gets drawn into the midfield in an attempt to kind of win the game, you know, to win the ball back when the chips are down. It seems to be a problem for both teams, that area between defence and midfield. I know you highlighted it, JJ, in your tactical preview for the game. Chelsea got quite a lot of joy in the opening stages, exploiting some of the gaps that United were leaving. Do they lack someone to finish off those chances at the moment?
Maybe you can see that Tammy Abraham's maybe not going to be the boy who's gets them 20 goals a season, but he'll
harsh after one game.
No, exactly.
It wasn't a brilliant start for him.
I think he'll come good, honestly. It just takes time. Like, once he gets a bit of confidence and he knows he belongs at that level, I think he'll be decent for Chelsea. It's tough choosing between him and Giroud as well. They're different kind of players, but Abraham's got more pace, and that's one of the things that Lampard's looking at, because as I sort of addressed in this tactical preview that I wrote, Chelsea are going to absolutely batter some teams, but are going to get destroyed by anyone who attacks, especially through the middle on the counter. And it happened 3 times against Man United. It was so clear from watching it in pre-season where the problems are. And you can see it in build-up. So when Sarri had them building up from the back, you know, they'd be quite deep, the centre-backs would be split, and then the full-backs would push up, and then you've got 3 midfielders in Sarri's, always in that kind of triangle. But now Lampard wants them to not just tip-tap for the sake of it. He wants to get the ball forward. It's kind of more direct play. And it's definitely him in transition at the moment. Because you see, like in pre-season, for example, we'll come into Man United in a second, but in pre-season what was happening was the centre-back, rather than passing side to a full-back or inside to Jorginho, would just play it straight forward to a midfielder. Normally, actually, one of the wide forwards would drop into midfield to pick it up. Like Pedro would come from a wide position to deep to pick it up, who would then turn and hit over the top. So it's like 3 passes would get you in behind the defence rather than 190 getting you towards the final third when Jorginho was doing all his bits and pieces. But you saw it here against Man United, that if you do that and your fullbacks are really wide and high like they're meant to be, and you're playing a 10 rather than 3 midfielders, so you've got Jorginho drops between the 2 centre-backs to make it a 3, then you've got another one floating about who was Kovacic, and they swapped around a little bit. And it's floating around, and you've got a 10 who is Mount at times and Barkley at times. It means there's this huge gap between defence and attack. So if you lose the ball, and especially if you're playing direct passes, like Zuma's not the best passing out in the back. He's a good player, but he's not good best at that. It means that the turnover possession just leaves you vulnerable right through the middle. Liverpool will go to town on them if they play like that ever again. And Man City, exactly the same. I'd imagine most coaches will be watching that, hoping they get to play them early before Lampard works it out.
Just a perfect game for Pogba, wasn't it, on Sunday? Like, you could absolutely thrive with that sort of direct balls over the middle. Just seems to suit him incredibly well. Although Frank Lampard said afterwards it was never a 4-0. I had a bit of sympathy for him, Sam. Did you agree with that?
Yeah, I think so. I think watching it, the balance of play was relatively even. I thought, JJ, you're completely right about them getting exposed through the middle. But when Chelsea had the ball, they were quite neat in their build-up. They made a few chances, particularly in the first half.
Good players, though, don't they? So you'd expect them to.
Yeah, but they were doing fine. They were more than pulling their weight, really. And then the issue they had was that at one end of the pitch, the ball wasn't sticking to Abraham. He was just letting it go every time. He wasn't holding it up well enough. And at the other end, Zuma was struggling, and it was erratic, and the penalty he gave away was stupid, and he also a bit loose with his passing, as you mentioned, JJ. Mm. So they're sort of at either end, they had weaknesses, but in the middle I thought they did some quite good stuff. And I was particularly impressed with Mason Mount, and I know Lampard was bemused that Mourinho had sort of criticised Mount afterwards, and I thought Mount had a really good game. He was sort of involved all the time. He put some good deliveries in, did set pieces, and was sort of there was a big chance he had when he tried to cut back for, I think it was cut back for Abraham, and he sort of scuffed it, and that was a big moment, I think, at 1-0. But beyond that, I thought he had a really good game, and Chelsea had quite a few encouraging moments despite a pretty depressing scoreline?
I don't know. I'm going to be honest here. From last week when we were talking about all the Zen-like approach and how everyone was going to be so patient with Frank Lampard because he's got this youth and he wants to promote it. Firstly, I don't reckon their youth are as good as what United have when it comes to youngsters, if I'm honest. I do think Martial and Rashford are exceptional players who it's different when you're building them up or giving them more of a chance over like a Lukaku or whatever it is, because one of them has been playing Champions League football with Monaco. One of them is like, you know, a prodigy. I'm not saying to you that Tammy Abraham's not going to be that kid, but from just judging the way that he's playing the game, there's a lot that he needs to learn. And that's going to take a lot of time, from holding up the ball to timing his runs, because there were just so many chances that it would be a tap-in if he timed his run perfectly. Of course, you know, we've seen Sterling grow in, and there's nothing to say that these guys aren't going to be even better than whatever United have. But I think that, you know, what irked me a little bit was that he said it was four mistakes and that's why we were done. No, it wasn't four mistakes. We saw Solskjaer in this side. We know that they don't have a midfield. When you don't have a midfield, your only option with pace up front and no midfield that can control the game is counter-attacking football. We knew that at one stage that's what they're going to do. So your mistake is not having found a way to try to deal with that. The fact that they didn't have to do that in the first half and that you dominated was luck. It wasn't that you guys were stupendous. They are a counter-attacking team, and you have to see that was going to come at some point. So where was the benefit in what did you try to do to make sure that doesn't happen? And yes, you know, there is the Kurt Zoomers and stuff, but they shouldn't be exposed. You know, you shouldn't have to put them under that kind of pressure. I do think there were lots of attacking mistakes as well, and that wasn't noted either. There were many chances that you had, and you should have converted them in the first half, but you didn't. What I wanted him to come out and say, it wasn't four individual mistakes. It's like, guys, if you want me to work with this team and you want the youngsters to progress, then we're going to have many games like this. Let's not beat about the bush. This isn't just about a couple of mistakes. This is the fact that this is a young squad, and it's going to take time for Tammy Abraham to realize when to do this and when to do that, how to hold the ball up, how to work with his teammates. It's going to take time that I get back some of my veterans who can help with this, whether it's Kante, who's fit enough to do that or not. But I thought that him coming out and looking a little bit defensive in the way that he was saying everything, I don't think was realistic.
Yeah, not a great look for him. Leicester at home next up for Chelsea, which feels like quite a big game already for Lampard. Let's just return briefly, Mina, to the matters off the pitch. What did you make of Mourinho in the studio? Why did you like him?
I loved him because I just think that he's very, like, matter of fact, you know?
He didn't look delighted to be there.
No, he looked very miserable.
And he was desperate to be like, I can't wait to get a job, you know, like back in football, so I don't have to do this. I don't think that he has a very, like, love for any pundits. And he was, and I thought that he made the point of, you know, he's like, listen, I would have played experienced players, but I don't know, you know, like at the end of the day, I hated it when you guys came out and said I should play this, and I'm like, God, you don't know anything, you don't know what's going on in the dressing room. And I thought that was a very, like, interesting thing to say, because he did say, you know, why aren't there no more experienced players for Lampard to be playing, but at the same time said, I don't know what that is, I don't know what's going on in the dressing room, who's available to play, I would have done this if I had a full team, but you know. And I just feel like he was kind in when he was trying to say something, but at the same time, very matter of fact, which is why we love him, because he's blunt, right?
Yes, he should work well in that role, I'm sure, until someone gets very desperate and gives him a job. Let's move on to the two favourites for the title, Liverpool and Manchester City. Impressive starts for both of them. Both of those games, for different reasons, were potentially games that those teams might not have been taken that seriously, potential banana skins. Was I wrong to expect anything else? Was it inevitable that Liverpool and Man City are just so well managed and such well-oiled machines that this was always going to be two big wins?
I don't know. I mean, it's the most competitive league in the world, except there are a clear front two who are quite a lot better than everyone else. I thought Liverpool were outstanding because Norwich did well, and I like the way that Norwich came out and tried to put them back a little bit. Maybe weren't expecting it. And they did well. Timo Pukki's movement off the ball was fantastic. His goal was really well taken, and they'll do well this season, I think. Man City are just a different level. Like, West Ham didn't know what to do with them, and West Ham are good. Pellegrini was moaning about Pep's tactical fouling, but I mean, that's just how you do it. But then you hear all these different versions of the same thing as 6-second press and all that. But if someone's coming towards your half of the pitch and you don't want them to do that, you foul them. No one moans at Spurs doing it all of the time. Like, Man United used to do it all of the time. It's just stop and play so you can reset and get back into shape. But Raheem Sterling's two goals, well, he should have, that little bit where he maybe would have had three, would he? But...
All right, we're going to have to do this. As you know, Audio Football Club fans, your guarantee this year is we're never going to discuss VAR for longer than 1 minute on every podcast. Let's start the timer, producer Joel. Let's get it going. So, the VAR thing in the West Ham game. I agree with Adam Hurry, who has basically said over the weekend that offside is a matter of truth. It doesn't matter where the cutoff point is in offside. The tech is always going to make any sorts of decisions extremely marginal. So there's no point complaining about the degrees of tightness involved. Do you agree, Sam?
I quite like the argument that you should change the rule to if any part of your body is onside, then the goal should stand, or you should be onside there, so rather than any part of your body being offside.
Doesn't change the nature of the argument, though, does it? Because it's just a different way of deciding what on and offside is.
Change the rules, but VAR's right.
Right, yeah. I thought Peter Walton was good on BT Sport as well. He says, we accept it when the ball is a millimetre over the goal line. By the end of the season, fans in the media will accept it when it is a millimetre offside. Mm-hmm. He's right, isn't he?
Yeah. If it's that good and it's that tight and they can rely on it, and the referees certainly seem to believe that that's dead on the technology they're using to get these lines to show exactly where they are. The only problem with it is... to do with frame rate, so if you've got, say, 24 frames to a second and it's paused at exactly the wrong one, that could... Yeah.
At what point is the...
And that's it, I'm afraid that's the end of the VAR discussion for this episode. Very well done. Let's go back to Man City. What about Rodri? Impressive debut for him, JJ.
Yeah, he seems to just know what he's doing.
Very good on the tactical fouls.
Yeah, that's what you want from him. Like I said last week.
It's a skill yeah. Knowing how to do a foul that's not going to get you booked.
Yeah, you've got to read
the play. I think it's a really big thing in continental football. Like, as in, when people don't do it, I'm always really shocked by it. So if Man City didn't go about doing these things that Rodri did, I would have been like, why are you not doing that? And I think you're relatively poor.
And I don't think it's Pep telling them to, like, you're going to tactically foul. That's not how you coach it. It's just that you try and stop them. And if you realise you're in a bad situation, you try and take them out. Like, it's not... It just makes perfect sense.
Jorginho did it yesterday for Chelsea when he looked at his teammates and he's like, guys, and he took a yellow card.
Well, that's not a tactical foul, that's just a hack. And I am all about
it. Well, he tried to be a little bit more elegant about it.
It's just that if you're just wide by the halfway line, you might realise you're not in the best shape to defend a certain attack. So you just sort of tip them up a little bit, hold them back before it becomes a problem. Makes sense.
West Ham are a bit pathetic, aren't they? West Ham's record at home to City in the last 3 or 4 years is abysmal. Like, they just ship at least 4 or 5 goals every time they play them at home. And you look at it and think, I know Pellegrini loves playing attacking football, and I love Pellegrini, and he's a great manager and he's got a great record, but like he's got to change his shape up a bit when you play City. You can't try and play your game against City. They're so good that you have to at least try something a bit more defensively, like resolute. And the fact they just got taken to the cleaners again. Yeah. Like, first game of the season, like, at least, like, give your fans some hope that something might change. And they're going,
so last season, the teams we did best against them are always, had a back three or five and a forward three. So they'd try and engage high up the pitch so they could just get onto any mistakes and launch attacks that way. But they always had five and sat really deep when City had the ball and blocked off. That's kind of the template to beat them. But when you do that, it tends to be that they just pass around your final third until they eventually score. So I still like it when managers... think, well, I've got a good team, I spent some money on this, you might as well have a go, it's the West Ham way after all.
But they had Declan Rice and Jack Wilshere playing in midfield.
Yeah.
And obviously Jack Wilshere's not the most mobile, and he's still building his fitness
so
up again.
Who would you
I know
wanted?
He's had a good preseason. A third body. Lanzini played number 10, but Lanzini's not, he's a creative player, he's not going to get in the way of the City sort of passing machine. And you just look to all those players like De Bruyne, Rodri, David Silva, Mahrez coming in, like, it's completely outnumbered.
But you see he's going man-to-man, you could have your 10s going to stay on Rodri to make sure that he can't link play all the time there, and then you have your other two bodies. Wilshere and Rice would be man-to-man with De Bruyne and Silva. Was the other one playing, was it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but you're not going to win those duels.
What do you mean by duels, though? Like individual tackles? Or well, they move so much that it's better to be zonal, because they're moving so clever, they just run across you, and so it's constant communication, which is why it's just easier if you've got everyone behind the ball.
Yeah, this is honestly what it is. But it's weird, though, watching them, and then watching Liverpool, then watching Man City, and I actually watched it the other way around. I watched City first, and you could see with City, it was a case of they won, like, okay, fine, West Ham were hopeless. But it was because they were so beautiful going forward, because they were so switched on and they had that chemistry between them. And Sterling was just on another level of madness. He was so superb to watch. And actually, they weren't at the very best in the sense that they were a bit sloppy. Sometimes some passes were taking too long to get to take off. But you thought that this is a really great team. Incidentally, when I was watching Liverpool against Norwich, I spent most of my time just laughing at that Norwich back line. Yeah. And with, I don't mean that with like a, you know, disrespectful, but I understand that they want to play attacking football. And I get that. And all I've heard is all these compliments for how exciting it is to see a team want to be progressive, but not if that's your backline. I am sorry, but I just thought I was just sitting there being like, this cannot be happening. Am I the only person that's like, are you crazy? Get somebody back there or offer some protection. This is still Liverpool. Like, at least I get it. You want to go and do something. Maybe they thought to themselves, we're not going to win against Liverpool, so let's just try having fun. But I do think that in terms of going forward, like, these guys had no awareness at the back. Hanley, for me, is just, no disrespect, I'm sure he's a really great guy, but really on a Premier League centre-back, he's not going to cut it with the way that he was playing his football. He had no awareness of what's going on. I saw him a couple of times pointing to where other players should be, and it's like, well, you're not in the right position, dude. So I do feel like with that, I have no idea how Norwich City are going to stay up. I mean, I don't know. There are going to be teams that outscore them, you know? So it's not like their front line is so good that another team, like, you know, your Everton's, your Leicester's, these guys are going to destroy them with that back line.
Something I did really like about Norwich is when they did score their second half goal, so slightly on the edge of doing this, but Timo Pukki did, like, try and get the ball and run back towards the centre circle. Like, come on, we can. And it's like, no, come on. We're not convincing anyone here.
And people are like, yeah, but he's already established himself as a Premier League player. That was such a great performance. It's 90 minutes, yeah. Let's just wait a second.
In context, right, they're playing at Anfield against the European champions, one of the best attacking sides I think I've ever actually seen. So you know they're going to score at least one. So you know you've got to score if you're going to win. So you might as well.
Yeah, like,
the way that could be what it is. Maybe they just thought to themselves, let's just have fun because we're not going
to
win.
There's time for them to improve that defence. Let's quickly talk about Liverpool's goalkeeping situation, Sam. Alisson will be out for a while. Are you convinced Adrian could do a job in this place?
I don't think Adrian will be anywhere near Alisson's level. And we've seen what an impact Alisson had last season when he came in and replaced Simon Mignolet. And just the composure he's got at the back, the sort of the coolness he exudes. And you do wonder that what kind of knock-on effect that will have on the defence. Obviously, Van Dijk's there and there's a very confident back four there, which has obviously won the European Cup, had such a great season. But you do wonder if that will be a major, major issue for Liverpool going forward. Because Adrian, obviously, he's not really played that much football in recent years, and he was a good goalie at West Ham a few years ago, but he's not a top level keeper at all, and Alisson's one of the very best there is, so there's no way that doesn't have an impact.
I will just say that Alisson and Adrian does sound like a really lovely 1980s wedding, which I'd be delighted to go to. JJ, we've had a listener question addressed to you from our friend Lubanza Chama, who's got in touch via afcpodcast@telegraph.co.uk. He says, how best can a team trying to play out from the back take full advantage of the new rule that allows defenders to be in the penalty box during goal kicks?
Well, it depends entirely on the situation and what you're playing against, because some teams will try and engage you high next to the box. Others will just drop deep. Like, for example, like Southampton want to try and constantly press and press and chase and chase, chase. But Burnley were just like, well, we're not going to do that. And then we're just knocking their goal kicks as long as they could. So there's no even benefit to it. But you'll see some teams you can pass out from the back, especially like City will do it. So the centre-backs, rather than being split either side of the centre of the box, can now be either side of the six-yard box. But the whole point is to create angles and passing. All your passes, you want them to be diagonal. You never want a sideways or a straightforward. You want it to go at an angle, so you've always got another link that can take it up to the next level and your team can move up the pitch. So it's going to really depend on who they're playing against, how good your passers are. Arsenal are trying it an awful lot, and I'm not sure they are quite the best at it yet. But whoever's on the ball, it's because you saw as soon as Arsenal were doing it, they were right deep in the six-yard box and they were taking it. And then what should then happen, ideally, if you're passing it from the back, is your goalkeeper becomes a sweeper. But if you don't do that, and straight away, if your centre-back's a level with a goalkeeper and he's not a sweeper, he's just a sideways pass, and then he has to basically clear it or go back sideways and you can close that down. It's pretty easy to close a gap. So I don't know what the best way to do it, but you'll see lots of innovations. One of the things you definitely can't do is scoop it up back and head it back to the keeper. That's been banned.
I thought that was pending further review, or has that now been?
I think it's because it comes under those like non-official laws that it's too cheeky, so don't do it.
Yeah, it's like scooping the ball up and heading it back from outside the box.
But it's the same way you can't just do keepy ups and head it back. Yeah. You know, I always wondered about that.
Yeah. But, yeah. A great shame.
I love cheeky.
Let's talk about something which has happened in between podcasts, which is transfer deadline day. Some action at Arsenal, Sam. They bought some defenders and they sold Alex Iwobi. What did you make of their business?
I thought it was quite exciting. It was they were in my books the most sort of dramatic movers, I think, in the last week. I think you can't really argue with the Tierney and Luiz signings. I mean, But let's start with Luiz. He's obviously experienced, quality defender. He can play that technical game, which Emery's trying to instill. And he signed for 8 million, which they sold Laurent Koscielny for 4.6, and they sold a 19-year-old left-back called Dominic Thompson to Brentford for a fee that could rise to 4 million. So they more than made their money back on David Luiz already, and they've essentially just swapped Koscielny, who's a year older and a lot more physically frail, for one of the best defenders the Premier League's seen in the last 4 or 5 years. So
that's really high praise for David Luiz.
Do you not think? I mean, he was a key part of the Antonio Conte's team that won the league. He was a central figure to Sarri's team that came third and won the Europa League.
No, he definitely achieved success, and he was part of the Brazilian team that was also smashed 7-1. But
of course. I mean, no one's saying that this guy's like the solution and the best centre back in the world. But he, I think, in the last few years, I mean, can you think of one high profile mistake he's made the last couple of seasons? I can't.
That's probably on my scout. Also, as well, because he's, I think he's probably, that's from what I've seen him, he tends to be better in a three, just because the way that works, you're a bit more, a bit safer, and he can be the sweeper where you can play balls about. He can come out to midfield because he likes to be in midfield. So if you're in a three, it's far safer if you carry the ball to midfield and
absolutely,
hit it.
Absolutely, yeah.
And that means something that Arsenal can do as well. I think Tierney is going to be so good for Arsenal.
Yeah.
And for, not just because he's good at the football, but because he's the kind of young leader, captain that teams at Arsenal haven't had for just ages. He's like the kind of that just driven determination. You've got to be a bit mad to have it. He's absolutely definitely mad, a bit mad. We'll give them,
I think that's
so
exactly
much
what they need.
Yeah, and he plays a bit like, he'll be a bit like a Monreal kind of replacement. It's similar in the way that he gets up and down the left, likes to attack, he's very good at it, but he can also do a shift at centre back. But it's what he brings kind of character-wise to that team that makes him such a good buy.
A fun fact about Tierney, he broke Aubameyang's club record for the vertical leap in the medical, which is when you hands on hips and just jump up in the air.
Really?
He got the club record.
Yeah, apparently that's because they showed him how much he's getting paid per week.
Nicely done, JJ. Elsewhere on transfer deadline day, Wilf Zaha denied his move to Everton, seemingly quite annoyed, but got a lovely reception at Palace on Saturday, so I'm sure he'll tough it out for another 6 months at least. Andy Carroll has gone back to Newcastle, possibly to restore his waning powers, but
I like
quite
that
possibly
move.
Not. Yeah, maybe. Maybe that'll work.
I really want him to be good again. Yeah. I love Danny Carroll.
I liked his cab. Icon. It's like,
What about Spurs, Mina? Two late signings for them, Lo Celso and Sessegnon in. Are they looking better than they were last season? And do you think they should keep Christian Eriksen?
It's a difficult question to answer because obviously Eriksen was so the difference maker in their match against Villa. He came on and it just looked like he was just
changed the game. Yeah.
Yeah, he changed the game for them. Having said that, they didn't play Lo Celso, and he is also Sessegnon actually. And for me, Lo Celso is one of those rare talents that you have so beautifully, so beautiful in his manner, his vision, his touch, his technique. The fact that he can play in the midfield or he can play as a false number nine, his movement, the way that he reads the game. So potentially with him around, you don't necessarily need Eriksen if they all find a way of like coming together. You've got options there. I would like Eriksen to stay because I still think that while he may not play every single match, he knows how to make a difference. But I do think that they made some good purchases, and I'm excited to see Ndombele next to Lo Celso.
Also, Vertonghen was on the bench. Well, not even the bench. He wasn't even in the squad, which apparently was just a decision, Pochettino said. But he was sat, I mean, I'm not saying he's done anything, but he was sat in the stands next to his teammates with sunglasses on, looking very much like he'd just come off the back of a 5-day stag do. So
maybe that's what happened.
Well.
Yes, let's ask the lawyers about that one. Let's stay with Spurs as we wrap up the rest of the Premier League weekend. A good debut for Ndombele, Harry Kane back looking sharp. JJ, they must be feeling optimistic after that victory against Aston Villa, coming from behind too. Mental strength from Tottenham.
Yeah, I really liked how Villa started this game, and I thought they were doing really well. And like Mina says, Christian Eriksen came on and pretty much changed the game. There's a few little individual errors that led to the goals. Jack Grealish in the first half especially was great at him. He likes to drop deep, get the ball, and then his first touch takes it just like a teasing amount away so someone goes to close him down, and then the next touch is a foul. He does it all the time, but in the second half later on in the game, I think Spurs are wise to this and just knew if you just go up to him and get it without letting him fall to the ground, you're going to be able to get away, which is exactly what happened for Kane's goal. I think Spurs... looked a lot better than I thought they would be straight away at the start of the season, and it's a good score, like 3-1, although it did take a while to come.
Hmm. I wonder whether physicality was something.
I think the issue that Villa had was that they had Wesley up front, and he was just, I mean, it's a tough first game in a new league, but like, he was not holding the ball up at all. Like, we're talking about Tammy Abraham earlier, and Wesley was even more loose with his touch, and every time Villa tried to play forward and play off him, he just sort of surrendered the ball and Villa and Spurs are back again. And you can see why Grealish felt like, and we said it, as you say, JJ, in the first half, Grealish basically was doing one-man counter-attacks, just getting the ball and just running with it.
He decided, isn't he?
I can't trust Wesley. I can't pass the ball to Wesley because he'll lose it. So I'm just going to run it myself. And that was what, in the 86th minute, that was what cost him that winning goal, really, which is when Grealish looked up and thought, oh, no, I'll go for it again myself. Got caught in possession and then the ball comes to Kane.
He is sort of the quality guy, but you looked also at the end with Jack Grealish and you felt like he sort of wasn't aware of his surroundings and then got dispossessed quite easily. And obviously that led to the goal. And I just thought that I didn't know whether they were just, when I say physicality, whether they were just really tired.
Might have been, it was a tough game. And there's just maybe the event, you're like, wow, we're doing really well here. Let's not make a mistake.
Yeah.
And then it feeds in. I thought Trezeguet, new signing, he was very good.
And John McGinn was excellent. Great.
John McGinn is such
McGinn
a good player.
He's
a
good player.
Yes, high hopes for Villa. I'm sure we'll be hearing far more about this and on that sort of tone from Matt Law as he returns soon to the audio recording facility. Result of the weekend, Sam, for Brighton, 3-0 at Watford. All their stats in that game were so far up on what they were under Chris Hughton. Graham Potter seems to have completely changed the way that they play. What did you make of how they performed?
I thought that was a remarkable transformation, not least because it's pretty much the same players who were there last year. It wasn't like the new ones all started. Trossard was on the bench. Mopay was on the bench.
Yeah, and not only that, players who had previously been in the team and not looked that good, like Dan Burn, the centre-back.
Yeah, exactly. And I think it was the third goal, the one that Mopay scored, when Dunk sort of put the ball up in the middle of the back three, sort of charged forward and played like a defence splitting pass. And that, I mean, Dunk's got a good range of passing, but we'd never seen him do that before under Hughton, never that sort of incisiveness going forward and that bravery in the pass. And that, I think, spoke a lot about what Potter's instilled there. And I think, I mean, I spoke to Potter when he started at Swansea last year, and I also went out to Sweden to speak to him the previous season. I think he's a really engaging, interesting guy, and he's got a master's in emotional intelligence, and I think he understands how a millennial mind works. And people always talk about, you know, Mourinho had that great hold over people of a certain age, but then when younger players came through, they were perhaps used to being treated differently, didn't like being shouted at as much, or that, you know, that cliche that's been stuck to Mourinho from that. And I think Potter's sort of 10 years later, he's the one who's got, I think, this sort of natural connection with that age group. And I think a lot of young players are really buy into what he's trying to do.
I don't doubt that, but a master's in emotional intelligence does sound made up. Was it from the University of Life, by any chance?
Isn't that something you either have or you don't have? Like, you either have, like, I don't know, you either have EQ or you don't. I can't imagine you being taught that, you know, like, I don't know. He is the Lord and Saviour. Like, as in, can I just say something? I feel like, JJ, you thought Brighton could go down, right?
Based off what I saw last season, yeah.
Based on their squad, it's a bit thin.
On the squad, yeah, what they've got. And then, but I've been going through this Brighton's game. I'm writing a little tactical piece on it just now, and you can see Potter's hands all over it straight away.
This is what it is.
Specifically,
he's so smart.
There's just diamond shapes all over the pitch. So they defend in diamonds, like literally the one player at the tip, one at the bottom, and then two wide. But they're all over the pitch. So when they go wide, it's a different. I mean, and the players are swapping position during these moves, overlapping, underlapping to keep that shape, and. They let it go for a little bit at the end of the first half, which is understandable, just new to it, and they were a bit scrappy in the second. But as soon as they put on Andone, is that his name?
Mm-hmm. Andone,
came on, that seemed to like wake them up again, and that's when they started scoring again.
He took gambles. He believed in the guys that, you know, had come on last year and didn't do anything special. One of the reasons why they didn't go around, I mean, they did spend money, but they didn't want to spend so much, was because they thought that this is a man who can change our team. He can make the ones that didn't do very well perform a lot better this season. And I just think that he makes it fun for everyone. So you do want to engage in this, like, you know, diamond defending or being like, everything is done in a way where you don't feel like it's a chore and you have to do this. It's not like you're being pressed, being like, win the ball. He has such a connection with his players, and he's got such crazy ideas, but so smart because he's studied so much that I feel like Potter, for me, I mean, I want them to be in top 10, and I think they can manage it.
What Potter does really well is improve players, as you say. I mean, you look at last year, Dan James went from pretty much unknown to being a £20 million winger. And even Ollie McBurney got a £20 million move for Sheffield United. Like,
yeah, I mean...
Yeah, come on.
That's proof of a wizard.
Yeah, yeah, he's indeed.
And Donny's going to be good for
the team. But he's a coach. He's not just a manager. He's a coach. Yeah, and he makes players better. Yeah, who's a coach who can also is a very talented manager, whereas I think we might be seeing some managers who might have been better suited as coaches.
Mm. Oh, there's going to be a lot of that.
Yeah.
Another 3-0 victory for Burnley against Southampton. Was this a case, JJ, of Southampton being ropey at the back or Burnley just attacking well and being clinical?
Burnley are just a nightmare to deal with when they're launching it forward and you've got fridge freezers running straight at you. It's exactly what they did. I said a bit earlier, Southampton really wanted to just like, they want to press you high and they want to engage you and like go at you and carry that momentum in. So Burnley are like, well, you're not doing that. Hold them at arm's length and then just shell the ball up towards the big lads. Really well taken goals. Like, all three of them are really well taken. Southampton will be fine this season. I really think they'll be quite good. But Burnley are just really very, very, very talented at getting these big lads to score goals.
Did you see Ashley Barnes was spotted in Five Guys after the match, still wearing his Burnley tracksuit post-match meal, which I think it's just so Burnley.
Yeah, doesn't suggest there's much of a dietitian culture at Burnley, or at least not a powerful enough dietitian. What about Billy Sharp, Mina? A goal on his Premier League debut for Sheffield United, played a couple of games for Southampton, of course. This was the only point for a promoted team over the weekend, and probably the least fancied of the three, Sheffield United. Were you impressed with how they took to their debut in the top flight against Bournemouth?
Yeah, actually, I thought that they were very good. I love that you look at me because you just think I'm going to be so angry. I looked at this team beforehand and I thought this was going to be a really special game because obviously Chris Wilder, his idol is Eddie Howe. So it's nice that they were like facing off in the first game. And I just thought, you know, with these, you know, these centre backs that bomb forward, and then obviously JJ was trying to explain that, and I think, oh my God, this is just going to be a disaster in the Premier League. But it looks like what's happened is that they really do understand this idea and this way of playing, and they're so used to it that it's almost become like chemical within them. They know how to do it at all times, and it was interesting to watch how fluid they were when interchanging their formations. Billy Sharp, 18 minutes of Premier League football. And he's just, there was just not a part of you that wasn't ecstatic at seeing him just get his goal. And you think, yep, you definitely deserve that. And I thought that they were really good for the points. So I really enjoyed it.
What about Arsenal, Sam? They got it done up in the rain at Newcastle on Sunday. Aubameyang, 33 goals in 50 Premier League appearances for him. Pretty astonishing record, but no room in the starting lineup for Pepe, Luiz or Tierney. Arsenal will get better than this, presumably, but how impressive was it that they got a result on the opening weekend?
Getting
a clean sheet.
Yes.
Yeah, getting a clean sheet away from home. I think they did that once all last season, and the first one was in April, I believe. So doing that in the first game is definitely encouraging. They have played with the back four, which has been their plan for the whole pre-season, to move back to that, having spent the whole of last season, well, the whole second half of last season playing with a back three. I thought Callum Chambers was excellent. He's had a good pre-season. He looks really solid. I mean, at the start of the summer, people thought he might go, I think including him. And then he's since come in and really cemented that place down. So I think it's going to be a battle now from based on this weekend alone for Luiz to actually get in the team straight away. I think that might not be as instant as people would think. Tierney will be a couple of months still before he's fully available to play, but he'll absolutely upgrade that left-back position, as JJ said. And then they also had all these young players playing. They had Joe Willock, who's had a great pre-season. They had Ainsley Maitland-Niles, who made the goal and was, I thought, brilliant throughout. Reece Nelson playing on the left. And Nelson will get more and more chances this year because Iwobi's now gone. We mentioned Iwobi going to Everton. And he had a good year on loan in Germany last season. He's come back. He looks fresh. He looks sharp. I thought he did really well. I thought he was far better than Mkhitaryan, not for the first time in the last few weeks. And I can imagine that when Pepe is ready to start, it will be Mkhitaryan who falls out and Nelson might stay on the left.
Mkhitaryan's weird, isn't he? Because he looks like he should be such a good player. He looks like someone who would cost 40 million or something. Mm. But all he seems to be very good at is controlling the ball, running with it, and that's it. And there's no... His shooting I've never seen be very good. He never seems to hit the target. Mm. Or if he does hit the target, it's always straight at the keeper. And then his final pass, final ball is always put... There must be a talented player in there because so many people have highly rated him. I read that he suffers quite a lot with the confidence, and that was one of the things that he did really well at Borussia Dortmund when he was under Klopp. He was so good there because he was, you know, beloved and he was the star of the show, and he kept getting told he was the best. And then that got kicked out of him a wee bit at Man United. But I don't know if he's recovered from that so much. It doesn't look like the player that I've always been told he is.
He's never to me, nailed down a position. Like, I don't know if he best on the right or on the left or in the centre. And every time he's played there, he's always looked a bit sort of floating halfway between positions and never quite delivering that final pass or that final shot. And you just think, where do you want to play? I'd love to have a chat with him and say, where's your best position? If he says, you know, number 10 behind Aubameyang, then fair play. But
where he wants to play.
Do you think
if Liverpool signed him in January, he'd suddenly look amazing again under Klopp?
Yeah, I think that there's a Liverpool effect. There's a Klopp effect, rather. And you saw that in Dortmund, because a lot of those players that left Dortmund just never lived up to those heights again.
Aubameyang's done it.
Lewandowski did it.
I agree with you. This is the problem with Song for Europe being so good,
Mina. We're now too well educated about what happens in Europe.
I agree with you on Lewandowski, but then you look at Götze. Yeah. You look at Błaszczykowski and Piszczek. I mean, it's not that they're bad, but Nuri Sahin going off to Real Madrid just didn't really hit it off. Whereas Vidal did so much better, and he was sort of considered the second best midfielder in the league from Bayer Leverkusen at the time. I do think that there are a lot of players who just... Shinji Kagawa. It's not that they became bad. It's that Klopp has this way of making an average player become better or want to kill for him or want to die for him. And back in... I feel like in Spain at the time, Pellegrini had that effect on certain players as well. And Gasperini has that on Atalanta players. So that when they leave, it's almost like the excitement and this desire and watching these films where they're like gladiators, it's no longer there. And then you might see them at the level that he is. But I'll be honest to you, I watch Salah. I mean, I'm sorry, Mohamed Salah was not going to be that guy for me. Mm. And then the first year, it's like the guy's a Ballon d'Or winner, you know, practically. And I do think that Klopp has just this way of just getting you to just want to do everything for your side and improve you and look at what you're so good at. And this is what I like actually about Graham Potter, because I do think that he does it in a different way. It's less motivational, but more like, let me speak to you, let me understand you, let me see what you want to do. And I think that he picks up on these things and makes players better. And then somehow when they leave, I don't know if they ever can live up to these past glories.
Coutinho. The
shape Coutinho is really important as well.
Another one, left Klopp and has been rubbish.
Yeah,
since.
Coutinho, exactly. Yeah, that's a good one, actually.
If you're a 10 for one team, it doesn't mean you're going to be exactly as good for another. So if you play, you're playing a 10 like for Chelsea back in Mourinho, it's a different role entirely to what you were doing at Klopp at Borussia Dortmund. So it happens to a lot of players. They think like Kagawa is going to be the next best thing ever at Man United when he goes there, but he's playing an entirely different kind of setup. And Klopp's players all run through the middle very fast. And because Mkhitaryan's very good running with the ball, that's why he looks so good when he gets to do that. But when he's not able to do that, he doesn't have quite the same quality of output as certain other kinds of players. So it's a weird one. He does suit it. But
quick word, Sam, on Ozil and Kolasinac, who were left out of the Arsenal squad. The ongoing blowback from the thing that happened with their car being attacked. What can you tell us about that? What's the latest?
I'll stick to the facts. The facts are that about 2 weeks ago, maybe 3 weeks ago now, Ozil and Kolasinac were caught up in this carjacking attempt, which I'm sure everyone's seen the video of. Mm-hmm. And then they both didn't play against Lyon the following week because Emery said they weren't mentally ready for that after... It was 3 days after the incident, so that seems perfectly reasonable. They both then travelled to Barcelona and played last weekend on Sunday, and both played and were there. And then on Friday, Arsenal said they'd been pulled out of the squad due to further security incidents. So based on that, we know for a fact that those incidents, and there have been at least two at separate times at separate places, have taken place this week since the Barcelona game. We also know for a fact that two men were arrested outside Mesut Ozil's home on Thursday night after an altercation, a non-physical one, a verbal altercation with basically private security staff that Ozil has hired in the last few weeks. So that's what we know. We don't know anything about the other situation with Kolasinac, if indeed, the nature of that at all. That's what we know. Emery says he doesn't know when they're going to be available to play again. They're clearly very much upset by what's going on, which you would be, and I imagine their families are too, particularly if there are threats at their homes, as was the case with Ozil. So this is, I can't think of anything similar to this, in terms of preventing players from playing before. Obviously Andy Carroll had the held up a gunpoint incident, which was horrific, and there have been loads of burglaries and robberies when players are out playing because they're on TV playing, so the burglars know they're not at home. But I can't think of any incident where two players have been deliberately left out and told their team, basically, I don't want to travel with my squad. I want to be with my family because I'm scared of their safety. So it's pretty unprecedented, and it's still ongoing, I think, would be the phrase.
Grim stuff. Let's hope they're back with us soon. Let's leave all that behind now and head to the continent. Merci beaucoup, Jules et Jim, pour le Gypsy Jazz Swing Spectacular. Let's talk about France, Mina. It's a song for Europe. Neymar, left out of the first PSG game of the season, seems like he's off. Where are Barcelona hiding their magic money tree? How are they going to make this happen?
I don't know, because if you find it, I'd like to know where it is as well. Also, what's the point of having Neymar if you have Griezmann and Messi and Suarez and it's just too many players?
Shirt sales, Mina.
Oh, indeed, indeed, shirt sales. Listen, if they do that, it'll probably be with Coutinho going the other way, potentially with another player attached to him. So that'll be interesting to see. They do really want this deal to go through, but right now they're trying to like look through the sofa to see if they've got any spare dimes to add to their collection to try to purchase Neymar back. In the meantime, I think that their interest is even more like they're even more annoyed about everything because Real Madrid have now been linked to the player. And while I don't think Zinedine Zidane wants him because he really wants Pogba, he wants that midfielder. I think that Florentino Perez really wants a commercial revenue sort of avenue the way that Ronaldo provided for them before. He thinks Neymar can provide them with that now. AS did a survey and asked Real Madrid fans how many of them want Neymar, and 60% said they don't want Neymar. Juventus were also linked with him, but they're too busy trying to sell Dybala to somebody who'll take him, so they don't actually have the money for him either. But it doesn't really matter because they won 3-0 on their opening day of the weekend because Kylian Mbappe is a star, and Cavani, you know, feels strong and capable and is going to stay there until the end of the contract, and they're still a strong team whether Neymar's there or not.
Another 3-0 in Ligue 1 over the weekend was Monaco losing 3-0 at home to Lyon. A very soft post-VAR decision. I'm not going to start the clock because we won't be discussing it. Cesc Fabregas was sent off for Monaco. How broken are Monaco on this evidence?
I mean, look, obviously we know that they had a terrible season last year and that there was all these changes on the bench. I don't think this is much to look at in the sense that if you are somebody who believes in patterns, Monaco tend to always do badly in the first game of the season, or at least in the beginning, whereas Lyon have not lost the first game of the season since the 1990s. So I don't know, maybe this is something just like they always come out from the blocks and know how to do something special, or Monaco are a little bit fragile at the moment. Obviously losing Fabregas to a red card is huge, and that gives Lyon all the power. They are a strong team, obviously we've seen that before. And they've brought in new players, having sold so many of the others. But I don't think yet we can say anything, but it's going to be a very hard season for Khartoum at Monaco.
Where are the rest of the European leagues, Mina? When do we get them back?
So we get Spain from the 16th of August, and we get Italy from the 24th.
Tardy.
I know. I don't know why, because they're going to enjoy Ferragosto, and then they're going to be like, yeah, well, we've still got Positano and Napoli, and, you know, like, let's just enjoy the Amalfi Coast for a little bit longer. Also, I do think that they have this belief that if they reach the Champions League final, they don't want to have 3 weeks in between the end of the season to sort of when that is. So they want to be like momentum running, because they really do feel like on this occasion they have really good teams that could do something in Europe.
Good news for Atalanta then, for when they make their fairy tale run to the Champions League.
No, they're going to be out straight away.
Let's finish off with a question that we put to our friends on social media, which was, after a young Liverpool fan ran into a lamppost chasing after Mo Salah's car and broke his nose, which footballer would you risk injury to get a photograph with? At United DZ said Dan James. He would be tricky to catch. And someone who might be a little bit easier to catch these days come from Matt Richards, who said Titus Bramble. Sam, who will you injure yourself in order to be photographed with?
I'm ashamed to say this because it shouldn't be my answer now, but you know when you're a kid and your childhood hero is just so much ingrained in your mind that he's a hero, but Michael Owen.
Oh.
I saw Michael Owen in a press room end of last season, and I was just like, it's the first time. And I was, you know, you see footballers in this job. It's the first time I thought, it's the first time I was a little bit starstruck. And Owen's a really boring guy, and like his career really dwindled a bit, obviously. And but for me, as a kid growing up, he was the man. He was the man. So he's the one I probably most like to get a picture with.
Mina?
Sorry, but you know when you say you meet lots of footballers, it was really funny because when I was in Juventus, I was supposed to do an interview with Ronaldo, but they cancelled it because of all these like things to do with his private life. And then he just walked past me and I looked and I thought, where do I know this guy from? And it took like, honestly, like a whole minute to realize it's Ronaldo.
Did he look different in the flesh?
No, I just don't know what it is. I think that I was so lost in my own mind, you know, thinking, oh, I'm so annoyed that I'm not going to get this interview now. You know, they're giving me like Chesney as an alternative. I'm like, there's a big difference here, guys, you know. And he just walked past and he was like smiling with his like beaming smile and like thousands of diamonds just all sort of balancing off the mirrors. And I just thought, how do I know you? Like, where have I seen you? He sort of looks like he's a Hollywood star because he's so gelled, you know, and he's so shiny. But anyway.
When you describe him as being sort of made entirely of diamonds, I'm imagining Homer Simpson when he's made entirely of gold and the biggest man in the world going, ha, 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 which is quite on brand for Ronaldo.
One thing I've noticed about footballers, and I'm going on a massive tangent here, and you might well have to edit this out, but the footballers obviously, like, they are just blokes. But I find, in my experience, footballers are bigger in terms of bone structure, not in terms of muscle or, like, beef, but in terms of just bone structure.
Oh, my God, have you seen Antonio Conte?
Yeah.
His head is like, enormous. It's a bubble head. Like,
for example, Eric Dier is my height, but Eric Dier is a much bigger man than me because I think simply just bone structure, like, his head is bigger than my head. And he's got bigger, like, knees. It's really weird. Like, it's not muscles. It's not like bench press or like bicep curl stuff. It's just like structure. Like,
I mean, he is stronger.
He is more solid than me as a human being.
How do you work out your bones in the gym?
That's also, what it is, because
it's not muscle. It's just like, you know, when you shake his hand is much bigger than my hand. He's just structurally bigger despite being the same height maybe a similar weight.
Did you give us an answer, Mina?
No, my answer was, I'm embarrassed to say this. There's only one player I've ever fancied in my life. And I used to stand outside his hotel room.
Oh,
it's Pierluigi Castaraghi.
Oh, a good choice. A good choice.
JJ. I would never have guessed that in a million years. I used to love Alan Shearer when I was growing up. God, he was good. But I've actually waited outside Pittodrie a couple of times to try and get the players' autographs. And one day, Ebby Schofield, the then manager, came out and we got him to sign our shirts. And then me and my pal told him all the football manager wonder kids he should sign. And we almost got relegated.
Redondo would have been one I would have killed myself for. He was my favourite.
Redondo?
Player. Yeah.
I mean,
never dramatic, Mina. Never dramatic. That's your lot for this week. You can contact me on Twitter if you would like to before next Monday's episode. It is at Tom with an H Gibbs on that website. We also have an email address. You've heard it once already in the podcast. Why not hear it again now and send us an email? We'll read out the best of what you send us. The address is afcpodcast@telegraph.co.uk. Don't forget to subscribe for the podcast. Just look for Audio Football Club wherever you get your podcast. You can leave us a review as well, if you like, on Apple Podcasts. We had a lovely one this week from somebody calling themselves Comedy 92, who says that we swerve the puns and in-jokes of every other football podcast, their capitals, but still keep things light and entertaining while being really insightful. Look, if you want to join Comedy 92 and have your nom de plume read out into this microphone, then please leave us a review. They're very helpful to us indeed. Thanks a lot. Thanks also to Joel Grove on the buttons, and thanks to you for your company. I'll talk to you again soon.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.